لله وكفى وسلام على عباده الذين اصطفى أما بعد اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد وبارك وسلم اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد وبارك وسلم اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل سيدنا محمد وبارك وسلم. There is a problem in economics which is known as the problem of scarcity, and that problem is predicated on an understanding of an almost irreconcilable physical reality. And that reality is that on the one side you have unlimited human wants, you have unlimited human desires, and on the other side you have a limited amount of resources. So if you were to give, you know, a young child as many nerd packets as he could have or she could have, they would want the whole world, a whole valley full of nerd packets. I mean, if you give him a chance, but then there's not that many nerds produced every single year to fill up an entire valley. So what do? And you can apply this to any, you know, other category of human life. That in general, whatever the category is, that people generally want a lot, but there's not a lot to go around. So that's the first, that sets the ground for the problem. And in this problem, it's important to understand that whatever the commodity is, it doesn't necessarily have to be an important commodity. As long as it's a commodity that is scarce, it becomes important. So it's not dictated by the inherent value of the commodity, it's just dictated by the market pressure. And then we take it to the next step, and we understand that if you are in a economic system in which there is scarcity, then to acquire anything in a scarce economy, you have to give something. So you have to give up or trade off something so that you can acquire something, because whoever possesses or owns something that's scarce, they're just not going to give it to you. You have to give something that you have that is valuable enough to that other person that justifies them giving you that scarce commodity. That's generally how the equation will work. So if we understand this, and then we understand the law of supply and demand, and that's the most basic principle of macroeconomics, that market pressures and prices are, in a capitalist economy, are set by the pressure of supply and demand, meaning if there's a very limited supply of something and there's a high demand for that thing, then the price will be high. And if you allow a self-adjusting market, you know, depending on what the supply and demand will, they will automatically adjust the price for that particular object, and the market will perpetuate itself. So in light of this view of supply and demand, then it's easy to understand that the more scarce something is, the more valuable it will be. The more scarce it is, the more costly it will be. Meaning the supply is very, very little, and if the demand is very, very high, meaning that the want for that thing is very high, and the demand is very little, then people will be willing to pay a very high price for that same thing. So, I mean, you take it for properties. I mean, if you look over here in New Tampa, 25 years ago, this was all, you know, pastures and cows were walking around, and they could pick up a property for, I don't know, 25,000, you know, US dollars, and you'd get acres of land because no one wanted it. Who wanted to be out here? In the same time, if you were to go to downtown Manhattan, right, where there's high desirability, there's very limited amount of property. You go to Mumbai, you go to Tokyo, you go to any of these places where there's a very limited supply and there's a high desire for something, I think, you can get a very small piece of land and a very small home for an exorbitantly high price. Right, that just sort of illustrates the same point. Now, the interesting thing about this whole system is everything that it just really not doesn't stand on strong ground in and of itself. It's all, we said that it has to do, what is the fundamental problem? It's unlimited wants on one side and limited resources. Resources are something tangible. Resources are something which are quantitatively measurable. But on the other side, how do you measure wants? How do you quantitate wants? How do you even understand wants? It's completely intangible, it's completely metaphysical, it's completely capricious. We have no control over it, and what you want one day will change the next day. So a lot of the variability in the market doesn't really have to do with the resource that's limited. It really has to do with what's going on the want side. And if you think about wants, and that's setting the market rate or the scarcity of an object, we quickly understand that those wants are often determined by social criteria. It's funny, because we said wants are not something which are stable. So what you want today might be different from what you want tomorrow. And a very good example is when iPhone 5 came out. Right? People were lined up at the door to actually pick up iPhone 5. They're willing to camp out the night before on Black Friday to go and pick up, you know, something for a deal. Because, you know, they really, really want it. There's social, there's marketing, there's a whole bunch of, I mean, this is what marketing is all about. So it sets up the social expectation, it sets up an artificial scarcity, whatever the case may be, and then people really want it. Now that same thing, right, that iPhone 5, now the iPhone 6 is on, and iPhone 6X and iPhone 7 is down the pipeline. But people are not that crazy about it. In fact, if I had to go out and buy a phone, and there was all these phones sitting there, I wouldn't even look at the iPhone 5. Immediately, I'd go and look at the iPhone 6. It's the same exact phone from a year ago. But in a year, so much has changed. Because how we look at that thing in society has completely changed. And so that affects how I look at that same thing. Now, even if it's $100 more or $200 more for the iPhone 6, I say, why would I even think about going for the iPhone 5? Doesn't even make sense, right? What a bad financial decision, a person would say. So again, social criteria have completely set what its value is, not in an inherent value in the thing itself. Because if it had inherent value, the iPhone 5 would be worth as much today as it was yesterday. I mean, it does have some inherent value in the sense that, you know, the processor speed is bigger on the iPhone 6 and, you know, it's a little bit slimmer, but I mean, really, do you really notice if it's 0.015 millimeters thinner and 0.012 pounds lighter? I mean, you don't even notice. It's just marketing. Practically speaking, who even uses their iPhone 6 to that capacity that they need to max out their processor? It's not like you're doing like multi-role playing gaming on your iPhone 6. You're just not, right? It's just the idea that people feel, oh, look, I got a better machine. So yes, there's inherent value, but it's almost negligible or meaningless for the average person because it doesn't really, I mean, I have an iPhone 4 that I inherited from my wife when she left. And, you know, like my mom's like, you should get a new phone. And I'm like, well, it does everything that I need it to do. And it really does, right? And it does it, I mean, at a speed that I'm probably comfortable with, even though I've dropped it more times than I'd like to admit. And it's still working, right? It's still ticking. So I don't really feel the impetus that, okay, why do I need to upgrade? Because now I have to transfer all my data, and yada, yada. I mean, it's working, no problem. So when we try to acquire scarce commodities in a market of scarcity, then we said already that you have to trade off things. And people are willing to trade off more or less depending on how much they want it. And when they trade off things to acquire those things, sometimes they do it, they try to acquire things which are scarce by virtue of their desirability, meaning how much people want that thing, not necessarily about how much value that thing itself has. You're just looking around you, well, everyone has to have it, right? This is the typical high school thing. But everyone's doing it. But everyone's going there. But everyone has, you know, where's, you know, Hollister. So if you don't wear Hollister or you don't wear Abercrombie, then you're the, you know, black sheep. Because everyone is doing it, you almost feel that this pressure that I also need to do it. I also have to want it. Not because you particularly like that more than anything else. I mean, there was a young man that was talking to one time outside the masjid. And I don't know how we struck a conversation, but it came up about music. So I was talking to him, and there was a song by... I had a khutbah on the subject of happiness. So this is around the same time that pop song came out by Pharrell Williams, Happy, which had gone viral, you know, on the global market. So I just asked this, you know, this young man, or me, I forgot how he came up, but he said, yeah, you know, I don't know if I really like the song, or I like it because everyone around me likes it. Right? And it was a very telling statement. Meaning that he's like, I mean, the song wasn't anything out of the, if you actually look at the lyrics, I haven't heard the song, but I have read the lyrics. And I was actually reading the lyrics because I was praying a khutbah on the subject, not because I'm interested in music. But when I was reading the lyrics, it was like, you know, very low level, you know, English, and didn't really have a lot of poetic value. But for some reason, because everyone had placed value on it, now he also placed value. So again, just to highlight the point that sometimes we judge things and how much we want things, not because how much we want them, but how much everyone around us wants them. And that's not necessarily a smart thing to do. It's really not a smart thing to do. You know, they say that how much does it take to be rich? And jokingly, they say that you need to make like 100,000 or 10,000 more than your brother-in-law or your neighbor. So it really doesn't matter how much you're making. It just matters how, like, are you really keeping up with the Joneses? And I recently read an article where there was a young lady who was saying that, I mean, she probably has a very good job, and she was living in Palo Alto, which, you know, is one of the most expensive zip codes in the entire United States, the Silicon Valley, when it had this huge growth spurt. I mean, the prices just went through the roof with this whole high-tech industries and IT boom and whatnot. And that still carries on to today, right? I mean, the values of the homes there are just ridiculous. She was saying that she owns a $2.2 million home and has an income, I think, above $250,000. But she says, I kid you not, I'm middle class. I'm being completely serious with you. I'm middle class because $2.2 million buys you a small three-bedroom, two-bath condo on the top of some store, you know, in the valley. So, yes, you're making a tremendous amount of money, but everything else costs more, services cost more, and so she doesn't feel rich. She doesn't feel rich. Now, if you look at the inherent value, and that's why when people get a job, they ask for cost of living adjustments. Because making $70,000 in Florida is not the same thing as making $70,000 in Manhattan, or making $70,000 in... you know, California, and it can be as much as 1.5 times of a difference in terms of the cost of living. I mean, people who've lived in New Jersey, they can tell you that that's really the case. What's another example of that? That's enough to illustrate that point. One of the questions that we can ask ourselves, if we have this in the back of our mind, is that, and we can use this as a litmus test when we decide when we want to get something, is that would you still want it if everyone around you had it? Right? Do you really want it? Or if everyone around you had a BMW, would you also want a BMW? If everyone could really afford a Mercedes and had a Mercedes, would you really be so motivated to work long hours to afford the Mercedes? I mean, this is a way for a person to differentiate whether they want it, right? They inherit, or it has some inherent value in the commodity itself, or if it's all based on this artificial scarcity or this economy of scarcity, which is predicated on wants, which is capricious. And oftentimes, that answer will come out a resounding no. You know, if a sister, she's looking that I need new clothes for a particular wedding. If everyone else were wearing the same thing, from that, you know, same designer, Hassan Shariar or whoever that is, then would you still want that? They're like, oh, that's, well, everyone wears that. What's the big deal? Why would I spend money on that? You want something different. You want something scarce. So the whole desire to have that one thing, if everyone is carrying a Burberry bag around, then there's no value for it anymore. You're like, okay, I need to get a Louis Vuitton. The value of it was because no one else had it. So you felt, wow, yes. But if it really had inherent value, it would have value even if everyone around you had it. Simple example is air. You want air as much as you want air, as much as you want air, as much as I want air. It's all around us. Everyone has it. But it has so much inherent value that no matter you're Chinese, African, Spanish, whatever you are, you're 6 years old, 8 years old, 80 years old, everyone wants it just the same amount. It's not scarce, right? But if you really needed it, you'd be willing to spend your entire wealth for just a breath of air. If someone's choking you, or you're in some type of situation where you can't breathe, you look at the person who's child is in status asthmaticus, and they can't breathe. The parents will literally dump whatever money they need to get their kids in the ER, $1,000 on an ER visit. Just give them ANAs, give them ipratropium, give them whatever you need to get the kid out of that situation because he's going to die because he can't breathe. It's air. It's free. But he can't access it, and you'll do whatever it takes so that you can access it. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in his holy book, بعد أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما الحياة الدنيا إلا متاع الغرور. It's really amazing. It's really amazing how we can take this whole 15-minute discussion and really distill it to like five words. What is the life of the dunya? وما الحياة الدنيا except متاع commodities which are full of غرور, which are deceiving. What is deception? Deception is when I tell you, hey, you know what? This is X, Y, and Z. I tell you this is X, you take it from me and it turns out to be Y. I've deceived you. So the dunya keeps on telling you, come and get me because I'm X. But in the reality, it's actually Y. Why is it that way? The reason why is in W-H-Y. Why is it that way? The reason is that way because if you take the dunya, it's all based on scarcity. And all of that scarcity is based on wants. And wants are just deception. Because wants have no reality. Right? And we talked about in this whole economy, things don't have inherent value. Things only have value that we have ascribed to them. I mean, is there really something that different about an Armani suit versus a DKNY suit? I mean, really, if you think about it. And actually, if you start going up after these levels, after a certain level, it just becomes ludicrous. And you look at what celebrities wear, and you look at what celebrities buy, sometimes you look at those things, and you walk into these type of stores, very, very high-end stores, and you look at it, and they have like feathers coming out from here, and you know some sequins sticking out from, you're like, it's not even aesthetically beautiful. It actually gets so removed, like some designer had some artistic epiphany and then they created this quote-unquote work of art, and you look at it and you want to throw up. But just because you've created this market which is so scarce, if people become so deceived, they're like, yeah, I want that. Why do they want that? Because, you know, if I buy a Burberry or if I buy, I mean, I don't know, whatever top brands they are, then that's just what the upper class rich. That's not what the ultra upper class wears. The ultra upper class has to wear, you know, stuff from such and such specific designer, you know, Carolyn, whatever her name is. And they want to go for those things where every, you know, dress costs $100,000. There's only so much that you can do to inherently increase the value of something. They're not putting like gold on it. They're not like lining it with silver. It's just the same dress, but then now they push it up to cost $50,000, $100,000. And really, there are clothes like that that cost $100,000 a pop, and people buy it. Same thing with homes. After a certain point, it actually becomes awkward when you actually walk into these ultra-modern houses. It feels like you're living in like some plastic Barbie doll-like house because it's not even aesthetically pleasing anymore. And they say, oh, this is from such and such designer fridge, but it's like in the shape of a potato or something. and you're like, what am I doing? Like, it doesn't even feel appetizing anymore. You lose your appetite. But because you also want a Frigidaire, or you don't want a Kenmore like everyone else, now you feel like, I have to have the potato refrigerator. وَمَا الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا إِلَّا مَتَاعُ الْغُرُورِ. What is the world of this dunya? It's just ghurur. You just completely be taken for a ride. You look at things for what they are, not how much people want them. And then that resets the balance. It comes, one of the other things they talk about, and I found this very interesting, is that whenever you have scarcity, so this is the second major principle, it creates something called competition. Scarcity creates competition, and what that means is that if there's some criteria that you need to have to gain something, you know, that trade-off, then people will compete for that criteria so that they can gain that scarce commodity. That's the general principle. It creates a competition, and we see that. Right? If society has defined money as the criteria for acquiring things, then people compete for money so that they can get X, Y, and Z. But it doesn't only apply to things of the world. It applies to anything that's scarce. Right? You see that with people who, even in Islamic circles, oh, I got to sit and have dinner with the Sheikh. So how did that change your life? Right? They do fakhr because it was scarce. No one else got to say, oh, the Sheikh said salam to me. Okay, he also said salam to another brother that morning. But the person feels special because I got something that no one else did. And then people start competing for that. And then it actually becomes ugly, right? What we call like the politics of religion. People start vying with each other to get in the good books of this sheikh or that sheikh. That's not sincerity. When people, for example, want to give the Jummah khutbah. Why? Because only one person can give Jummah khutbah and everyone has to sit and listen. So then people start competing for that because they want to be the one in front of everyone else. Why do you want to sit in a masjid board? Is it really so that you can serve the masjid or so that you can be on a board of something before you die? When you take anything that's scarce, people automatically start competing for it. Whether it's in the deen, whether it's in the dunya, it's human nature. It's human nature. And this is actually illustrated by the verse of the Qur'an. I mean, it's so amazing how the Qur'an is so short, so on point. It just says, أَلْهَاكُمُ التَّكَاثُرُ. Done. Like three words, or two words. أَلْهَاكُمُ التَّكَاثُرُ. Done. The entire solution, is to distract someone. The idea of you wanting getting more and more, this has distracted you. It's completely turned your attention away from Allah. It turns your focus away from Allah. It turns your life objectives away from Allah. And it becomes all these other things which are ghurur to begin with. And so then people say, oh, I can't find myself having love for Allah in my heart. And I find it hard to make dhikr. And I find it hard to do more ibadah. Why? Because our attention is focused somewhere else. It's going. It's the thing that's distracted us is takathur. In fact, there's a riwayah from Abdullah ibn Shakir, if I'm not mistaken. And he said that he entered upon Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and he was reciting the verse Al-Hakum Takathur. And then he said, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, the son of Adam, Ibn Adam, would say, Mali, Mali. Mali, Mali. My money, my money. My money, my money. People, I mean, if you really look at our own situation, how much of the day we're just worried or thinking about money, money, money. My money, my money. That's the mantra. When the heart should have been saying Allah, Allah, right? In effect, it's saying Mali, Mali. So he said, but do you have, O son of Adam, anything of your money except that which you ate? Or clothes that you wore, ablaita, and you made them old? Or that which you gave in charity, and you have sent it forth for yourself for the hereafter? It's a very, very deep statement. If you understand the economics of scarcity, it's a very deep statement. Because it's an entire shift, it's a paradigm shift actually. It's shifting the focus from wants to needs. it's a big thing. Because needs are material, they're physical, they're limited, they're quantifiable, they have a reality. You need water, I need water. You need air, I need air. You need companionship, I need companionship. You need shelter, I need shelter. The things that you need are solid. There's a reality to them. They're not guru. Right? Rasulullah also ate. He also drank. He also slept. He also engaged in all the needs that any normal human being would. And this was one of the actual objections that the kuffar had on the anbiya. يَأَكُلُونَ الطَّعَامُ وَيَمْشُونَ فِي الْأَسْوَاقِ, that they eat food just like us. And they also walk in the markets. But that was why? Because they had needs and they fulfilled those needs. And there's nothing wrong with that. So what are the things that Rasulullah ﷺ mentioned in the hadith? He said, what do you have from your mal except that food that you ate and it became waste? You ate it, but look, that was something which had inherent value. Moving from an idea of wants and desires to things that have inherent value. When you eat, it satisfies your hunger. That has value. Even if no one else is eating around you, you said, fine, you can be hungry, I'm going to eat. And even if everyone else around you is eating, it's still just as pleasurable to eat when you're hungry. It has no effect about how scarce it is or how not scarce it is. You just need food, you need food. Same thing with water, same thing with air. So he said that the food that you ate and you used, and look at the clothes that you wear with ablaita and you made them old. I mean, this is something that's touching your skin, that is so close and in tune with your reality, that it is it's something that's solid and material. And then the last thing he mentioned, and there actually is the real genius of the whole hadith. I mean, the whole hadith is genius, but one of the real take-homes is that which you send forth for the Akhirah, and you will find it basically there in the Akhirah. Now, why is that so important? Because there's actually, this paradigm shift actually has two steps. It has two steps. The first step is moving from the realm of wants to the realm of things of their own inherent value or things that are needs. Right, whether it's valued for its own self. So for example, if you like a particular car, you like a particular dress because it looks good to you, you can buy it. No problem. But do it because you like it, not because everyone else does. Do it because it has value for you or for your family or for your children, not just because that's the social trend. Right? قُلْ مَنْ حَرَّمَ زِينَةَ اللَّهِ الَّتِي أَخْرَجَ لِعِبَادِهِ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, who made haram for you the zina that he took out for his slaves? This is for you. If you're not going to use it, who's going to use it? If our wives are not going to wear pretty clothes, who will wear pretty clothes? The cows? I mean, it's for women to do zina. You know, if you don't drive a car, who's going to drive it? The monkeys? I mean, someone has to use these things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created for us. But the idea is that we do it because they either have inherent value and when it's a need. And then the second thing, so that was the first step, moving from wants, especially societally dictated wants and desires, to a person to becoming self-centric and to becoming need-centric. And the second thing is when you become need-centric, then you realize our greatest need is the need of the akhirah. The greatest need is the need of the akhirah. So that's what happens in this hadith. Rasulullah first mentioned food, which is like the basic need. Then he mentions clothes, which is not just a basic need, but you know, a little bit further from that. And then moving completely into the realm of the thing that you need the most, which is akhirah. That charity that you send forth, and you will find it there. And we don't think about this in economic terms. We don't think about our earnings in terms of ukhrawi terms. People are very good at following their 401ks. People are very good at knowing how much they're vested in their retirement income and how much the company is matching and how that particular fund is running and how the S&P pours. I mean, they're good at following that and knowing what's going on because they expect to get that at the other side. And it, they see that as something tangible. They see that as a need. They're like, oh my God, I'm going to retire and I have no retirement savings? Because that's a need. We have to look at our akhirah as our ultimate retirement. And if a person has no savings from there, we're going to be muflis there. No house there, no shelter there, no bad situation. I mean, if a place to really live it up is over there. And that's why Rasulullah said, if you want to do takathur, do it in there. And that's how what the deen actually does. It actually diverts a person's whole attention from doing takathur in the dunya. You can have from the dunya, you can take from the dunya, but the idea is not to keep on getting more and more here. The idea is to generate more and more for then. And you talk to any good financial planner, what do they say? It's all about getting rich slowly. Everyone who, for example, when you become a physician, people want to like live it up, and they say, no, you can't live it up. You need to pay back all your debts. You need to do this. You need to do this. And you're like, oh my God, I'm going to be 50 before I have any wealth. They said, that's fine, but you need to think ahead. Right? That's how you, or else you're just going to waste all your wealth. This is not smart. So wealth generation requires deferment, even more delaying of gratification. Right? Save up for a big down payment. Do X, Y, and Z. You know, you did 20 years to get through medical school, wait another 20 years. You're like, here, I'll be 60 years old. What do I want for that time? Just make sure that you have a good retirement income that's 80% of your income. I mean, they have all these different metrics that they say, there's a brother who recently went to like a meeting from one of these financial counselors. What did he say? He said that, no, when you're retired, you need like 5 people around you. You need a pastor. I mean, basically, like, you know, a religious figure. You need a good lawyer, because now people actually have an estate and there's like 40% death tax, and now you're worried about how much is actually going to go to your children and how much is going to be getting eaten up by the state. And it's amazing because Rasulullah actually had told us that let no person go to sleep except that they have a will that is written. I mean, just the firasa of that. And then you need a good financial plan. You need a financial advisor. And you need an investor, right? Like a person who will manage your mutual funds and the like, and a good tax accountant, something like this. It's like a small army. But the idea is, all of this is what? For your retirement. And at an age where you really have very little to actually just enjoy in life, our retirement, the akhirah, is of the nature that it doesn't end, it actually continues. People try to save the best for last in this dunya. We really save the best for last. And so that's really the take-home message, that if we have, this is sort of the progression of moving from trying to acquire things that just everyone wants, or things which are just valuable because they're scarce, to looking at things that we actually really need, or that we actually want, or our families actually want. And then after that, then moving from that to the next level of trying to focus on our ultimate need, which will be the need of the akhirah. وآخر دعوانا الحمد لله رب العالمين.